hearings, public hearings.
No, we don't. Possible.
Okay. Today is February 5th, 2015. This is the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Today we're going to actually switch the order of the bills that we're going to be hearing. It'll be a little bit of a different order. The first bill we'll be hearing is House Bill 2582, followed by House Bill 2584, followed by House Bill 2174, and then House Bill 2175. There's a witness sheet over there, so please sign up if you're interested in testifying on any of these bills. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2582. And before we do that, we'll have our committee administrator, Wendy Simmons, summarize the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members. House Bill 2582 prohibits association of owners or the person who creates a planned community or condominium from prohibiting display of signs based upon the content of the sign.
Thank you. The first witness we'll call up will be Chuck Schechtoff. If you could announce yourself for the record.
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Chuck Schechtoff, and I live in Silverton in a home on property within the bounds of a planned community and homeowners association, the Abaqua Heights Homeowners Association. I'll be brief about why we put this bill, why I asked that this bill be put in by Representative Barnhart and what it does. Our community is a community that the CC&Rs, say that certain signs are allowed in the community and other signs are allowed only if approved by the board. And the board of our HOA was taking the position that we don't allow any other signs. We can't allow any other signs. It's only the ones that are allowed in the CC&Rs, even though it says unless approved by the board. Now, when I bought the property, I read the CC&Rs and I thought, oh, I could probably get permission for certain other signs, like, you know, happy birthday or vote or something like that. And they were saying it was an outright ban. So I thought we should have legislation that says, that doesn't allow signs on every HOA. It just says on those HOAs where the CC&Rs give discretion to the board, that when they have discretion, they should not be allowed to do it based on content. As noted in my written testimony that I submitted to the record, while the impetus for this bill was I wanted to put up a vote yes on a school bond measure in 2012 and was told I couldn't and had to hire a lawyer to push to get that right to do that while this bill was being debated. The ACLU said, wait a second, you can't have a, and it was an amendment to a bill that was put in by the homeowner lobby, the homeowner association managers gang and lawyers gang last session. They said you can't do it just based on, it said election-related content. You can have an election-related bill. And they said, no, you can't do that because Robertson, which is the case that I believe is related to all the Oregon's billboard law, basically says the legislature cannot enact a law based on content, that restricts based on content. So while HOAs are private entities, are not governments, they're private governments essentially, they act like governments but they're private, and an HOA could have in its CC&Rs or its rules, if authorized by the CC&Rs, you're not allowed to have a gun on the premises or anything like that. You don't have constitutional rights that way. But they do, you can't put in the election related, you have to say just no content related. So this just goes to the limited number of HOAs that give some discretion to their boards to allow signs. If an HOA today says, a CC&R say no signs whatsoever, that's it. If an HOA today says you can have election signs, you can have vote for Representative Gallego signs, that's fine too. But if it says, or any sign approved by the board, nope. Then it can't be based on content. That decision should not be allowed to be based on content. I should be able to put up an election sign for any of you. And so that's what it does. And so it's scaled back from the original proposal back in 2013. It's just limited to just those HOAs where there's discretion. and it doesn't violate the Robertson line of cases. So amendments to say, oh, just have this for election sign, election related or something, wouldn't work. That would, or just have it for yard sale signs or whatever, wouldn't work. That would be content-based legislation, and the legislation would be unconstitutional.
All right, are there any questions for Ms. Sheketoff?
That's it. Very
All
good.
Right. Very,
I have one.
Yes, Representative.
Mr. Sheketoff, how will this bill reduce poverty in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gallegos, I'm here on my own behalf, not my employer's behalf, and it has nothing to do with that.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll now call up David Bennett and Kurt Powell.
Sounds good. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Bennett. I'm a lawyer in Portland, 1300 Southwest 5th Avenue, Suite 3500, firm of Lanny Bennett Blumstein. I've been practicing law for more than 43 years. I graduated from Willamette Law School, took my last final. I had a new baby and I needed a job. This firm had hired me. I walked in the door and the partner I came to work for said, here, kid, do this condominium. And I said, what is a condominium? So the very first thing I did 43 years ago was that. I've drafted documents for well over 1,000 condo project and planned communities. Our office represents some 1,200 homeowners associations, anywhere from a duplex to Sun River to Forest Heights to high-rise condominiums in the city of Portland and elsewhere, to condominiums that are spread out and basically walk-up kinds of things. So I just kind of wanted to give a background of a group that I belong to called the Condominium Study Homeowners Association Group. It was first formed in 1975, 76, 77. And there were two lawyers, Howard Feuerstein and I, a title person from Transamerica Title, the real estate commissioner at the time was on that, and one lender, and there might have been one manager. And so what we were looking at that point, the Planned Community Act didn't exist. It was simply the Condo Act, which was about 8 pages long. The Condominium Act now is about 65 pages long. I've been down here many times testifying for the legislative committees on amending the Condo Act. The Planned Community Act came into existence in 1981, and I was in that committee with Betty Niven, who was head of the Housing Division of the State of Oregon at the time, to come up with a framework for other kinds of homeowners associations, how they ought to be developed, and to have some kind of balance about how all those things worked. So our committee now consists of, you know, 5 or 6 lawyers, 5 or 6 property managers, some homeowners who are not otherwise engaged in the homeowner association management kinds of things, consultants, public officials, the head of the land division center for agency for the real estate agency is a member of that group. There are lawyers who represent only associations. There are lawyers who represent only developers. There are lawyers who represent only individual owners. So there's a considerable balance in this committee that now is probably 25 people, and we have consistently looked to try to get you folks to amend the Condo Act and the Planned Community Act in a way which makes sense and has a sense of balance for developers and for owners, for individuals, for governance by the board of directors. So I don't propose to talk specifically about this bill or the following bill, although I've signed up to testify on both of those, but I wanted to give you a flavor for the group that we have, and we've invited all kinds of people to be a part of this. We've had dissidents in the past, dissidents from our group, invited them. There was a substantial amendment to the Planned Community Act a number of years ago for a lady living in Mountain High in Bend. We brought her into our group and actually suggested an amendment that satisfied her needs as well. well. So I think that it's unfortunate if legislation comes about because of a specific incident. I think you have a governance. We represent a lot of associations. There's a lot of consternation, a lot of problems with some of those associations. And if people are civil to one another, they have some respect, and they try to address the issues, I think that is a better answer, a better response to this kind of thing than it is to say, I couldn't put a sign up that I wanted to put up, and so let's have some legislation about that. There's plenty of legislation now. I think we've tried to bring the Plan Community Act and the Condominium Act with respect to the association operations so that they're quite parallel. With respect to the development, they're different because they're different kinds of animals. So I respectfully ask you to not pass this bill forward. I think it is unneeded. I think it is assigned to address a one specific kinds of situation. Occasionally some sign issues come up, but I can tell you in the 25 or 30 years we've been representing associations, initially I didn't represent associations, and when I began to represent them, I could see my documents and go, why, who wrote that? And I found that I had written it. So we try to write them better so that they work for everybody. So sometimes we have some sign issues, but I'll bet you a sign issue in our practice of representing all those many hundreds of associations, it's maybe once every 2 years that that issue arises. So I would hope that you would not enact legislation to address one specific kind of problem. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll hold our questions till we get through. Mr. Powell.
Okay. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Powell. I represent Willamette Community Management, who represents a number of homeowners associations in the Corvallis and Albany area. I came here today to testify both with this bill and the House Bill number 2584 as well. As I've worked with our associations over the past 5 years, I've seen that each association has very different views on what looks appropriate in a community, and I think it's very important to give each one a each board of directors the power to represent their community well in a topic specific to signs. I don't know that I can add too much more to what Mr. Bennett here has said, so I guess I'll just leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions for these gentlemen? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Vice Chairman. So with your associations, when somebody moves in and they agree to be in this area, is it made clear to them what those restrictions are and are not, what types of signs, what types of content would and would not be permitted?
You want me to respond?
You can respond first.
Well, Representative Stark, first of all, there's all kinds of different sorts of documents with regard to that. Most of the documents that that I write proscribe signs just because people are living very close together. I mean, there are some homeowner associations where you got, you know, 10 or 15,000 square foot lots, and that may be different than you would have in a situation where you have a high-rise condominium. Nobody wants to go home at their high-rise condominium and see a bunch of signs in there. So I personally have never written documents that give the board of directors the specific discretion we can approve or disapprove this sign. And I would think that would be a badly written set of documents to do that. There ought to be some criteria about what they're in there, I think, and not give the discretion to the board of directors to do that. Now there can be things that are offensive, that are obscene, or whatever. You could have to say, we permit political signs, but we're not going to allow somebody to put a political sign up that says, you know, Representative Stark is a jerk. You know, I mean, I think that's a rational kind of thing to prescribe. You can say, I want Representative Layfield to be elected and not you. I guess you're not in the same district, obviously, but it's that kind of thing. So basically, I think it's a kind of a slippery slope when you have a lot of discretion. Not that they don't have some discretion, but with respect to signage, typically we proscribe it because you're living close together, and it's just offensive and to the ambience of the community to have a whole bunch of signs out there on a regular basis. So.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's an interesting topic, since during my campaign this became an issue in my own homeowners association, and because neighbors wanted to put up my political signs. So we got a legal opinion and said that based on precedents at the federal level that political signs could be put up in the neighborhoods. So I'm not sure where this falls in the state, but we were told that that's allowed right now in terms of political signs.
Well, if you're asking me a question, there, We belong to an organization called Community Associations Institute, and there's a national law seminar put on. We just came back from San Francisco. I've spoken at that. When there was one here, those of us that are in this field are usually the people who are giving the lectures. Yeah. So when I learn something, you go there. So there are cases all over the book with respect to that, mm-hmm. whether it's constitutional, whether it's not constitutional. I think the practical effect that people have is, in most associations, a short period of time, we're going to permit a political sign. We're not trying to stop political speech. We're trying to make sure that the ambience of the community isn't with a whole bunch of cluttered sign, whether it be, you know, come and get your nails done here, or, you know, I don't believe that we ought to have GMO kinds of food and that kind of thing. So.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Petty, you had given reference to that there was some other legislation out there regarding signs. And so I wanted to know what that was.
I didn't mean to say. There's another bill coming up later on.
You're referring to
refer to the second bill coming up. I would, if I don't want to hear me say the same thing again, maybe I'll just come up and say it's me again, and I say the same thing.
And I want to make sure that I also underheard your testimony correctly, is that Mr. Stark is a jerk. Sorry, Representative Stark is a jerk.
No, that would be the wrong.
That was entered into the record? Is it?
I think so.
Please don't put that in the record.
All right. And actually, in all seriousness, we're talking about protecting speech and things like that. I guess I'm also very interested with Representative Buehler about how prohibitions on speech in homeowners agreements, you know, that interaction between our constitutional rights. I'm kind of curious about, you know, what I mean, you're going to all the conferences, and I'm kind of curious what the current thought process is on that.
Well, it's a constitutional issue. It's constitutionally protected speech. That's really an issue that typically isn't addressed with legislation, and it typically isn't addressed in the documents. But when it is, somebody tries to enforce something that is prohibiting political speech, there's a court system for doing that. My experience is generally the Homeowners Association on a political speech matter are not going to try to be overly restrictive. They may have a time, a size, a place to put it. But the condominium homeowner associations are all different if you've gone out there to look at them. And they're from the high rises to spread out to 2.5 acre lots that are a homeowner association. So there's a benefit to having those things. People buy into these associations knowing that there's certain kinds of restrictions and things they're limited from doing to get the benefits that they want to have from living in that kind of facility. Mm-hmm. I personally choose not to be there. My wife said when we're old, we're going to live in a condominium. I said we are old and I'm not living in a condominium, but that's just my personal point of view. So other people very much enjoy that, and they want to try to enjoy it in a reasonable regulatory manner that has a nice ambience and not a lot of discord that's going to come about from having a plethora of signs or other kinds of things.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony today. Next on our list is Denise Bauer and Greg, it looks like Coxie. You could just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Denise Bauer. Go ahead,
Ms. Bauer.
Okay. Representative Rayfield and committee members, I am president of Community Management Incorporated, which is a management company in Portland. We manage approximately 150 communities. We've been in business for 43 years. And I'm also the chair of the Oregon Community Association Institute Legislative Action Committee, further called LAC, because it's easier. And David Bennett kind of referred to CAI. The LAC is respectfully opposed to the sign bill for a lot of the same reasons that I won't repeat. But what I will do is kind of recap the way the LAC feels. They feel it could affect markability as far as, again, if they say something like David Bennett said it might say. For the most part, most associations don't have a lot of mean-spirited people, but regardless of whether they have mean-spirited people or not, sometimes they don't play that well in the sandbox together. So it's hard to get board members to serve on the board, and if they are attacked in a format that they can't protect themselves, for example, a sign saying something mean about them, which right now we get via email sometimes, but it's private. It might go to a handful of people, so the boards are able to respond to that, or it might come at a board meeting, for example, and the board member is able to say, you know, that isn't quite exactly how things went, and let me tell you how things went, so they're able to protect themselves or at least respond accordingly. But when you have a sign up and everybody drives by it, it's sort of embarrassing, to be honest with you. And at that point, I think that we have a difficult time getting people to serve on the board of directors. And when people drive through the community looking at homes and they see that sort of sign, they're like, I'm not sure I really want to live in that type of community. It's also aesthetics as well as property values. We're not at all opposed to political signs. In fact, we encourage those as people deem appropriate. Washington State has a law that allows political signs. Not at all opposed to that. The option, I believe, if a board member does not represent an owner as they wish they would represent them, I believe that the owner then has the right at the next election to elect people who represent their positions, I guess.
Thank you. Mr. Coxley, or Coxey?
Coxey.
Coxey, there we are.
Vice Chair Committee, my name is Greg Coxey, C-O-X-E-Y. I am a lawyer with the law firm of Vile Fotheringham. I was started with Vile Fotheringham in 2001 as a law clerk, and then in 2003 I passed the bar and have been with the firm ever since. I also am here on behalf of the Oregon-Washington Community Association of Managers, also known as ALCAM. I am the chair of the Legal and Legislative Committee, and our position on this bill is that it should not be passed. There's, again, been a lot of different discussion. Ms. Bauer, David Bennett, I think that we've fleshed out a lot of these different issues. My concern is that we are dealing with one individual's bad experience in a homeowners association that is what brought the bill here to us today. A homeowners association, first and foremost, is a group of volunteers. In a lot of associations, it's very difficult to get people to serve on the board. It's a thankless job. The comment that we usually give to homeowners associations' board of directors is that there is no good deed that goes unpunished. There sometimes can be a lot of animosity in homeowners associations, and I think that that's basically what we're seeing here with this bill. Because of this bad experience that Mr. Sheketoff has had, I don't believe it would be appropriate to then have new legislation which would affect all of homeowners associations. In fact, in the number of years that I have represented associations, and just to clarify, our firm only represents associations. We don't represent developers. I have dealt with very few sign issues. There seem to be a lot more issues with homeowners associations that are more important, like pets or parking or those sorts of issues. I think that when you start to eat away at the discretion of the board, you start to run into problems. And I think also that the more regulation that you put into homeowners associations and condominium associations, the more opportunity these individuals who serve on the board have to screw up. A lot of the associations, they don't read the Planned Community Act or Condominium Act all the way through. They don't necessarily read their governing documents all the way through. In fact, a lot of owners in association, in closing, will just sign stating that they've read the documents when they really haven't. there's all sorts of different ways to go about solving this problem. As Ms. Bauer indicated, you could elect a new board of directors. There's also the ability under both the Planned Community Act and the Condominium Act to recall the board of directors. Associations also have the ability to amend their own governing documents. So that issue can be put before all of the owners in the specific association. As I see it, again, on the political sign issue, that's not what we're talking about here. I agree that we are not taking the position that you can't have political signs in associations. But the way that this is drafted is too broad. And, for these reasons, we ask that this bill be denied.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you very much.
And then we'll call up Jack Monroe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe. I'm a board member and officer of a Salem planned community. In this case, a planned community subject to Chapter 94 and not the condominium statute, which is Chapter 100. I'll be really short and hopefully to the point. But in one sense or another, this bill looks to me like a solution searching for the problem. And its enactment, I can tell you from my board service, is going to create some confusion. And it's going to impose some costs on existing planned communities, whether they're condominiums or they're planned communities under the Oregon Planned Community Act, Chapter 94. And in one way, it seems to me it's almost antithetical to the sort of philosophy and purpose behind these planned communities, which are essentially to consistent with state law, the two statutes that you have in front of you, plus they might have to be consistent, the associations have to be consistent with the Nonprofit Corporation Act and some other provisions, you essentially allow, you create it with the documents, and you allow people to essentially govern it, subject to, again, those documents and any statutory provisions that might be appropriate. And so if you're going to allow planned communities to deal with equally, potentially at least equally contentious issues like architectural issues and vehicle parking and the kind of occupations that might go on in a particular development, why you ought to interfere and effectively preclude regulation that deals with signage, I don't know. And understand that the kind of developments we're talking about out there, not only do they physically look different, I mean, high-rise condominiums in Portland, and you might have a planned community that has very large lots, somebody mentioned 15,000 square feet. So, and they're mixed. They're a mix of residential and commercial. So they're all commercial condominiums. There are condominiums out there where the first two floors, which are condominiums, but they might be commercial activity with the next four floors above it being residential. So there are lots of different combinations at play out there. Now this bill, as the at least initial proponent suggested, triggers with an association having the discretion to do something relative to signs. Lawyer Bennett has done hundreds of these documents, but I would guess that most documents forming these planned communities have and speak to signage. They probably do it differently. Now, the complex that I'm part of essentially says no signage, no signs, without board approval, but it creates an exception for sale signs. And, we can deal with that right now, in a second. But we've triggered. We've in fact triggered by virtue of the document and the discretion to deal with signs. So you're part of it. And, you know, something like a for sale sign is in everybody's interest. I mean, if you are trying to sell your house, you want to move it, and everybody else in the neighborhood has an interest too, because at some point in time they want to sell theirs, and they don't want to, you know, live in a planned community that has restrictions that make it difficult to accomplish that. There are other signs that clearly are of lesser value, and, you know, let me just deal, I guess, with a couple of things. City of Salem has a 54-page sign code, and it actually deals with some of the issues that are raised by this bill. In signage, there are really two issues, content and what the delivery mechanism looks like. Now, there are certain kinds of things that just shouldn't be put on a sign in a high density or any place, in a high density or any other locale. And, for example, the city of Salem says that, you know, any sign that is pornographic or obscene is prohibited, outright prohibition. Would you want to live in a high-density situation and have somebody slap a swastika in a window? You know, there are clearly some content-related issues that just shouldn't be in or on a sign. And then in terms of the delivery, what's a sign? It's designed to attract public attention. Sophisticated sign codes recognize a variety of issues. You know, they're not going to generally allow, if I'm talking about an ordinance or if I'm talking about a board making a decision, allowing for somebody to take the bottom of a corrugated box and slap a message on it with a Sharpie and post it on the property. I mean, it's not consistent with what most, at least, planned communities see as the objective of not having sign clutter, of having things be clean and orderly. When you go home tonight, I mean, take a look at sign variants that are out there that are attempting to grab your attention. I mean, they're illuminated. They have flashing lights. They have strobe lights. They have, electronic signs. You've got banners. You've got signs on vehicles. There are a whole range of possible permutations that a board in a neighborhood. And I'm speaking, obviously, of a residential kind of development, high density, that they're just not going to want to see. And but as I read this bill, you can effectively turn your complex into the functional equivalent of a college dorm situation, where, at least in my day, it's been a long, long time. Electric beer signs were popular things to have in the room and sometimes in the windows. And I mean, that's just not consistent with the objectives of communities like this. So somebody's going to have to tell me, given the language in this, how an association would, once it's triggered the apparent obligation, how they deal with objectionable messages. And how you would deal with a delivery system that's likely to be objectionable. And, you know, as somebody mentioned earlier, associations, homeowners associations, if, again, to use the residential example, they're all volunteer people who are doing it for the good of the neighborhood, if you will. And, you know, if you do something like this and impose essentially a practical requirement that they're going to have to lawyer up every time they want to deal with a situation, because the only limitations that are in this bill are time, size, and number. So, you know, you don't have the opportunity to deal with some of the other issues I've raised. That makes no sense either, to impose that kind of effective requirement on associations that are managing the activities of a particular complex. So I think with that, I would simply say, you know, there are hundreds of complexes. There's that mixture that I talked about earlier. And I think this clearly is would not be a positive move and a move in the right direction. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Morrow? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on House Bill 2582 that did not get signed up? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2582. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2584. And for time's sake, that took us 35 minutes to get through one bill. I'm going to ask that as the next folks come up that you limit your testimony to maximum of 3 minutes. If you can do it sooner, we'll be much obliged. We have three other bills that we need to get through today. I'll go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Simmons to introduce the bill.
Mr. Vice Chair and members, House Bill 2584 prohibits association of owners or the person creating a planned community or condominium from making the records of the association confidential or exempt from disclosure to owners of real property in the planned community or condominium, excluding information that is already statutorily exempt from disclosure. And the bill also defines the term records.
All right, and so we'll go ahead and begin with calling up Chuck Sheketov again. I think I'm going to get down pronouncing your name correctly by the time this hearing's over.
I think you have it correct.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Chuck Sheketov from Silverton, Oregon, and here in support of House Bill 2584. And I will be brief. Attached to my testimony are two documents. One is a copy of a PowerPoint presentation from a training that Vial Fotheringham did, and then also a blog post by an attorney there, which support my testimony today. The current law says all records of all business records of the association, all records of the association, and records kept by or on behalf of an association are available to members, except, and then there's a list of exceptions. That is spelled out clearly in the PowerPoint from Vial Fotheringham and in the blog post that there's all records are available, and then there's an exception. The problem is, there's debates about, and the firms like Vial Fotheringham defend boards who say, well, that's not a record of it. That's not in the list of exceptions, but it's not a record of the association, so you don't get to have it. And the purpose for this bill is to make it a little more clear what those two terms mean. It just defines them so that homeowners, I'm not surprised that Mr. Bennett doesn't see a lot of these cases, because who can afford lawyers to go after it? They ask him how much he charges his clients, and you'll find out how much it would cost for a homeowner to try to get access to the records. The Representative Bueller's Homeowner Association apparently had to hire a lawyer to help define it on the issue of signs. So all this does is define better, and it's based on Oregon Public Records Law, because using the same language that they use, I thought that was good guidance because that law works so well. What is a record of association? To get a little more clarity so you don't have to hire a lawyer to get something. I fully recognize that this committee cannot legislate out of the world the jerks who might be on a board, a one or two or more particular HOAs, and make bad decisions. You can't do that. But you can make more clarity in the law so that those jerks might not act like jerks in the future. Okay, that's the whole purpose of this. So that people like me don't have to hire necessarily a lawyer to get access to documents. So, for instance, my HOA has had a maintenance committee that would spend money, maintenance money from the budget, and report to the board. The board wouldn't provide those reports. My HOA, the Architectural Review Committee, it meets on an almost monthly basis and approves requests for changes to property. Lawns and plants and fences and the like, and paint and whatnot, and they give their minutes. They approve them. They give their minutes to the board. The board won't release those minutes. And now, when I've talked with HOA lawyers, we had a conversation with a few of these folks yesterday evening. They said, well, you should be getting those. Well, yeah, I should. But I shouldn't have to get a lawyer to go to do that. And that's the issue. You know, the folks who opposed the last bill and are going to oppose this bill do not always have the best interests of the homeowners at heart. This is a Consumer Protection Committee that last, in 2013, they put in a bill, House Bill 2823, which dealt with preventing embezzlement. There was a big embezzlement in the Portland, in the front page of the Oregonian in 2012. They had a bill in to require better auditing and financial records. They fell on their sword because these versions of these got amended to that bill, and they said, we won't negotiate, we'll let our bill die. Did they come back with that embezzlement bill? No. They have the interests of the manager.
Mr. Shekatov, if you could keep your testimony to the bill at hand, please.
Sure. So, you know, all this does is clarify that what's a record, and that the exceptions are the limited exceptions as far as what they may not have. That's how Vile Fotheringham explains it in the PowerPoint. You'll see it. They have it in caps, except these, and in their blog posts. That's the list. If they want to come in with other exceptions and debate those, they can have a bill to do that. But this just clarifies this law. Don't mess up a bill that just clarifies the law. If they want to come in and say, well, let's have advisory committee stuff are not business records, come in with a bill for advisory committees and try to define what an advisory committee is and why it's not part of the management of the HOA and wouldn't keep information and protect against embezzlement and the like. But that doesn't, you know, this bill, all it does is clarify existing law and give time frames. And one other point, yesterday I pointed out that it says, you know, provide them within 10 days. So you can't give ring or roll about how quickly you get something. You'll see in the Vile Fotheringham blog post, they say that HOAs are also governed by nonprofit law, and the nonprofit law apparently has a 5-day rule on providing some records, and that's mentioned in the blog post by Vile Fotheringham. So I'm willing to negotiate the 10 days and have it be a little bit longer, but have some type of time frame. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you again for your patience and your testimony. And again, I would remind everyone that we'd like to limit your testimony to about 3 minutes, as we have two other bills besides this one we need to get through. So we'll again call up David Bennett and Kurt Powell.
Representative Rayfield, again for the record, David Bennett, a lawyer with Lenny Bennett Blumstein, Portland, Oregon. Member of the condominium study group that has looked at all of these bills, the bills that are proposed today, the two condo homeowner association bills. this one's on the records. Our committee over the years has worked very closely with what ought to be a record, what should be available to homeowners association members, and that has expanded over the years. I don't know, there's a lot of controversy on the part of the people in our committees about that. Unlike sign issues, which come up very, very seldom in representing associations, record issues do come up, and we are consulted on a regular basis. We consistently tell our boards of directors that you have to deliver records of the association to owners who request that. You can't withhold that. So I think those of us who represent associations give that advice on a regular basis. This bill really has more to do is not that those records aren't available, but what is a record? So if we have a committee is not the governing body of an association. The records of the association of things decided by the governing body are and should be available. The information with respect to all the documentation in that association ought to be available. Sometimes the debate comes up as to a list of the owners. Who are the owners? Do I have to give the emails out? We got the privacy issues versus the right of somebody to try to contact other owners for political purposes. So I think this extends beyond that. There's some associations have 20 committees. So all those committees, those are the records that have to be preserved. It costs a lot of money to preserve those records. I don't see that when we're involved in homeowner association litigation, while these things can be discovered, email records, committee notes, if they have those, could be discovered. I just don't see that coming about very much in litigation. Associations are kind of political animals, and if you don't like what's going on, you should, you know, get yourself elected to the board, and that happens frequently. I tell some association when they have dissidents, if you don't like your board and you don't like your lawyer, get yourself elected and fire me, and that has happened a few times. So, and I think people ought to be able to do that. But I don't think we ought to put this burden on associations that we have all of these things that are records. We have to maintain them. And there, I think there's a certain amount of discussion that needs to be on committees that doesn't need to be a part of a permanent record that somebody has to provide. And if they have the record, it's discovered in litigation, it's discoverable, that's fine. But I think you put a tremendous burden on associations if you extend what are records to email trains, discussions. Some owner sends in an email to the board and wants something about it. They may not want that publicized, and it's not really a decision-making kind of thing. I don't believe it's a record, and I would hope that this committee wouldn't recommend that be a record. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for keeping it brief.
Did I do my 3 minutes all right?
You did fantastic. So, Mr. Powell.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kurt Powell again. And of course, as we work with homeowners associations on a regular basis, we have lots of emails coming our way and to the board of members. The way I read this, it's talking about any information prepared, owned, used, or retained by a member of the board provided to them, and that really could mean not just information for them to be used during a board meeting, but also concerns from owners, perhaps inflammatory remarks as well. I don't know that it's appropriate to have those be public record, but a board is an acting body of the association, so everything that they use that's necessary for them, I think, is appropriate to certainly share with owners. But I think this may include some other items that are not intended to be in the record. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for these gentlemen? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and call up Denise Bauer, Greg Coxey, and Jack Monroe. All right. Whenever you're ready, state your name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Denise Bauer, Chair Fagan and committee members. I won't repeat what everyone else has said in essence of saving time. What I would like to point out, though, is the current state statutes specifically say that all documents of the association are available to homeowners. As I said, I've been with the company for 43 years. I do represent the Legislative Action Committee, LAC, and they are respectfully opposed to this bill. The state statutes say exactly three things that are not available to homeowners. One of them is documents in relation to an executive session. And as you probably know, executive sessions are usually somewhat sensitive. It's often related to either building defect or manufacturer defect, or perhaps even an ADA situation or something to do with one of the other homeowners within the community. That's a legal action that's being taken. It might be accounts receivable. That's basically the only things that you can have in executive session is meeting with your attorney. So it's sensitive material. The second thing is personnel records. And of course, there are labor laws relative to personnel records. The third thing is other people's personal individual files. So that would be, I want to look at your neighbor's file or my neighbor's file. So those are only three things: documents related to executive session, personnel records, and other people's individual files. So I feel that the amount of documents that are not available to owners are fairly limited, and the rest are available. I do not believe that the law needs to be changed in any way. Thank you.
Mr. Coxey.
Greg Coxey, for the record, here on behalf of ALCAM. Again, there's been a lot that's been said. The bill is being somewhat sold as we're just trying to define a little bit better what the records are. It's our position on this that it goes too far. It's way too broad and is unnecessary. As what Mr. Bennett said, we also, as lawyers, tell associations that they need to share records, that there are records of the association. And as Mr. Sheketoff pointed out, we do PowerPoint presentations on this. We do blog posts on this. And, you know, I'm pleased that he is reading our material. But, again, it's too broad, it's unnecessary, and it's, unfortunately, his experience with his homeowners association. So I think that if he can get on the board of directors, he can fix these problems within his homeowners association and not affect the rights of all the other associations in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Monroe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe again, and as I said before, a member of a homeowners association board. This bill, and I haven't had a chance to spend a lot of time with it, but does, and it's obviously already been indicated, does several things. It seems to redefine records or things held on behalf of the association to include emails and text messages, I presume, and other things for a bunch of private citizens who are compose the board of a plan development. That's not likely to happen. And if it happens, it'll happen at significant burden. The other thing, and that's the language in Section 1, creates the new Section 22. As has already been indicated, there are existing statutes that tell organizations what they have to keep and how long they have to keep it. And, you know, if you look at, for example, Section 2, which starts at the bottom of page 3, we have to keep our turnover-related information perpetually. And then beyond that, the records in Chapter 65, which is the nonprofit corporation statute, tells us what we have to keep and how long we have to keep it. It's a little bit like dealing with the IRS, where you can get rid of everything after 7 years, assuming that, you know, you're not – haven't been perpetuating fraud. So then we, you know, the only other new addition is on page 5, and I don't know, I'm not entirely certain what that means, and I'm not entirely certain if I look at either of the two existing bodies of law, the Oregon Plan Community Act or the Oregon Condominium Act, exactly how many times it might speak to records and how long they might have to be kept. There is one element to that language, however, that bothers me, and I think maybe that Lawyer Bennett referred to it. The language that's here in sub B at the end seems to suggest that that we might have to turn over to a third party records for duplication. And you know, I can tell you that I'm sure that the lawyers in the room would not recommend that you turn over documents that you are legally required to keep to somebody else for duplication. Just a language-related issue. I mean, there are all kinds of places in the statutes where you are entitled to get something and at a reasonable cost, et cetera, but you're not required to turn them over. And I think this language suggests that you are, and, you know, that would just be foolish. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we'll now call up Eric Hoag. Oh, I got it right on the first time.
Did all the committee members get my written printout on my written testimony?
Yes.
Okay. Vice Chair Rayfield and members of the committee, I'm in favor of House Bill.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, yes. My name is Eric Hoag, and I live in a condominium in Washington County, and I notice that most of the people that come to these hearings are industry, such as the management companies and the law firms for homeowners associations and some board members. It's a minority of people that are just plain old homeowners like myself who have been, in my case, I've been dealing with the board for over 5 years and learning the tactics that they use to keep things secret, ignore document requests, and have private meetings by email. So I'm fully in favor of the broadest definition of what is a record and what is available, and so I'm in favor of this bill. In my written statement, I put in some things that I would like to be more specific in the House bill, and Chuck Shakatov hit on one of the key points I was going to make, that we need clarity in the law, and so if we can actually mention things like emails and owner's list and audio and video recording of board meetings, that would be much better when there's a disagreement between the homeowners and their board, because it's complicated and expensive for an individual homeowner to argue with the board about the interpretation of a law, such as, is the owner's list a homeowners association record that homeowners can get, or is it a personal file of every homeowner? Is it a files of individual owners, they say. That's what it says in the Oregon Condominium Act. So it should be great if there was just like a complete sentence that says the owner's list is available to the homeowners and they can get copies of it. And for what purposes? In the House bill, it says for a proper purpose, and I would like to expand on that. What proper purposes are, such as creating a newsletter or campaigning for an issue or a candidate. Without the owner's list, I noticed that several people have said, well, if a homeowner doesn't like the board, then they can run for the director position themselves. But that's not even possible if a homeowner doesn't know who the other homeowners are and how to contact them. So it's essential for the so-called democracy to have the homeowners list or the owners list. Emails, I'd like more detail about could a homeowner, for instance, subscribe to the email discussions that the boards are doing, because a lot of things are already decided by email before they ever come to the open board meeting, and so that's getting around the open meetings rule for board meetings. And and this is real specific to what happened to me, that I made an audio recording of a board meeting and I got fined $400 for doing that. And so this House bill is all about making records available, defining records as available that are communications between board members or between board and committee members. And so it seems like the audio and video recording would fall right into that category of documenting board communications. And there was House Bill 3317 in May of 2011 that originally had a provision that boards of directors could ban the recording of board meetings, and that the House bill it got resistance from the legislature, so they took out that ban provision, and the rest of the bill passed unanimously. So that tells me there is a consensus among the legislators that recording should be allowed, and yet there's still nothing one way or the other in the law books about whether the board can ban recording. So it's up to individual judges, and so that's why it should be more specific in the law. I also noticed that the board and following the board's directions, the management company will make it as slow and inefficient and expensive as possible to access records, and yet when a director wants that same record, well, it's just a few keystrokes and the director has a copy of that information. There shouldn't be a double standard. It should be specific what is reasonably available, because the board can make it so expensive and painful to get a record that nobody's going to get a record. There shouldn't be a double standard there, and there should be a price provided by the legislature about how much can be charged to get copies of records, because right now there's no limit and there's no definition of what's reasonable. Okay, that's my main points. I'd like to answer any questions.
Thank you, President Hogue. Are there any questions? Well, thank you for taking the time to come down from Washington County. I know that's important to come down here for you. That's quite a ways to come. So, is there anybody else here to testify on House Bill 2584? I just want to thank everybody for limiting their testimony to 3 minutes, and so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2584.
And now I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2174, requested by the Secretary of State. Ms. Simons will summarize the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2174 deletes a requirement for the Secretary of State to prescribe the form of contract for the conduct of municipal audits. The bill allows the Secretary of State to direct certain state agencies to withhold 10% of specified state funds, otherwise to be distributed to the municipality if a municipality fails to submit their audit report. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. With me is Mary Wenger. She's the deputy director over our financial and municipal audit function. So I will turn it over to her to talk about the bill, and then we're both here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, Chair Fagan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss House Bill 2174. This bill authorizes the state to withhold 10% of state funds if a city or county fails to file the required audited financial statements in a timely manner. Withheld funds would be released after the required filings were made. In addition, this bill eliminates the requirement that municipalities use a Secretary of State prescribed form when they're contracting for their audit services. Oregon law requires that most municipalities hire an accounting firm to audit their annual financial statements, and the current law requires that a copy of that audit report be filed with the Secretary of State's office, the Audits Division. The smallest municipalities are only required to file a self-prepared report of their financial activities for the year. All of these required filings serve an important purpose. They provide one measure of a government's financial management, they promote fiscal accountability, and they create a deterrent for possible fraud. Unfortunately, the municipalities don't always file the required financial statements. In fact, 62 municipalities were over 1 year late in their filings as of February 2nd, 2015, and some were late by multiple years. Further, many municipalities that miss their filing deadline do not contact the Audits Division to explain their delay or to even seek an extension with us. Although a statutory mechanism for cities clearly allows the withholding of 10% of state funding when cities and counties fail to take adequate steps to correct problems that are identified in the required filings, there's no statutory mechanism that clearly applies when they fail to file in the first place. House Bill 2174 addresses this by giving teeth to the filing requirements. Our current agency policy when a municipality does not that fails to timely file is to maintain open lines of communication with the municipality and to grant it a reasonable extension when it has shown good cause. Secretary Brown is committed to continuing this policy. Finally, as a housekeeping matter, House Bill 2174 would also eliminate the requirement that all contracts for conducting audits and reviews are in a form that's prescribed by our office. Most of the municipalities are already required to follow the Oregon Public Contracting Code. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill. We're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from the panel? Senator Buehler?
I have some questions. I find this topic very, very interesting, but I realize many other people don't, so I'll try to keep my comments brief. Is this an increasing problem with regards to municipalities doing their annual audits? You said there's 62 now. How many weren't being done, say, in 2011, 2012, 2013? Are we going in the right direction or wrong direction in that trend?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller. I don't have that information with me. We started a couple years ago trying to encourage them to file on time. We started capturing that information for delinquent filers, and we were trying to brainstorm ways to encourage them to file. So now what we do is we post it on our website, and we are in contact with them. Generally, the deadline that they are to submit the reports is December 31st, so we have there's quite a few that don't make that deadline, but it diminishes from that point until July. And so these folks would be the 62 would be for fiscal year 13, June 30th, 2013. They have not filed their June 30th, 2013 statements, and some have not filed their 12, fiscal year 12 statements. But we don't have any accumulation if that's improved or not. We're hoping that it has improved.
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, just there are 1,700 municipalities in Oregon, so we are capturing a huge number of them, and in fact, just starting to talk with the local governments about this bill has inspired many of them to take more action. So there is a deterrent effect to these kinds of activities as well, but the largest governments are generally on time unless they've got good cause. We get down to special districts, irrigation, water, some charter schools, various very small governments in most cases. So it's rare that there's a large government that would fall behind that much.
So another follow-up. So let me get this right. So just until a couple years ago, you didn't even know how many local municipal audits weren't being done on an annual basis?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller. No, we track that. We have an individual in-house who's the municipal audit manager. And so he is tracking how many are delinquent and following up with them. What we started a couple years ago, we implemented another process to encourage them to file on time.
Another question, thank you.
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, we started posting, and we call it kind of our wall of shame, where we put up those that were delinquent, and that got some attention also. So we've besides sending letters on a periodic basis to prompt them to report, we started putting something out publicly. That got some more action, and this bill actually closes the loophole that we think maybe there that allows us to make sure that they file and there's some sanction in place if they fail to file, with that withholding 10% until they do file.
And I think that's I'm very supportive of what you're trying to do. What I'm trying to get at is if you've been tracking it, and you should be able to tell me if this is an increasing problem or decreasing problem over time in terms of local municipalities doing their annual audits. I mean, I realize you just started posting it, but then somewhere in the agency, you should know if you've been tracking this, if you have more or less now than you did in 2010, 11, 12, onward, right?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, we can go back and see if we can recreate those earlier numbers. We did know year by year how many were delinquent, but whether we've kept those numbers to be able to do that kind of an analysis, we'll look that up and see if we can get you an answer.
No.
One more, sure.
And if you were tracking them, why weren't you requesting them? So why didn't you say X municipality, where's your annual internal audit?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, we send out numerous letters. We contact them, we contact the governing board, and we're doing everything, you know, we see our role in the statute. We are making sure that the CPA firms are conducting appropriate audits, that they're meeting the standards. So we're looking at the audit reports. That's what we are tasked with. And we are trying to encourage, because they get frustrated too. If they go out in the field to do these audits, the entity is not ready. So we are trying to, going at it from all different angles, working with the firms, working with the League of Oregon Cities, trying to encourage these municipalities, because they serve the public, and trying to encourage them to stay current. And the longer they get behind, it's harder to get current, and there's a potential for fraud. So we are trying to make efforts, and we're taking it from different angles. And
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just had one question that had to do with, I mean, what kind of money are we talking about? One, in terms of the fines, or what you anticipate might be collected?
Chair Fagan, Representative Gallegos, what's left usually at this time of the year are very small special districts, cemetery districts, irrigation, water. They do not get state dollars. So we don't have much control over them because they're based upon rates that they're charging their customers or their clients. But in terms of cities and counties, the numbers get small rather quickly. Oak Ridge is a good example. A number of years ago, it had failed for 3 years in a row to get a financial statement. We'd been in regular contact with their financial officers, with the accounting firms, pushing them. We really didn't have much more we could do to push on them because, you know, again, the powers for us to be able to force them to get an audit when they didn't have their books in a condition to be audited was very difficult. Ultimately, that came back to bite them, and they had to borrow money from Lane County. They had to lay people off. It was a serious problem. That kind of got us thinking, let's explore what more we can do to intervene in these cases. So in many cases, it's 10% of state funding that's withheld. So it's not a large part of their budget, but it's enough to get their attention, we believe.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So kind of in the spirit of the Consumer Protection Committee, which to me kind of says looking out for the little guy, and I think you kind of answered this question a little bit in parts, but I'll just ask it anyway. So the city of Portland and Eugene are not likely to be on your list on the naughty wall or whatever or anything like that because they're big cities. They have accounts and stuff. But I have this image in my head of these smaller municipalities, some Oak Ridge, for instance, which was kind of a struggling city, and they had some problems, and kind of problems beyond the scope of this law or this bill or this committee. But I have this image in my head of some small town now being beat up on by the big old mean state of Oregon because they didn't do an audit. And I'm with Representative Buehler that. You know, you want to have cities or municipalities be in compliance, but on the other hand, is there a way that you can maybe help them out with the audit or something like that, rather than you have a city that's apparently not performing all that well, at least on one level, and you're going to deny them 10% of their money, and that doesn't seem to me like that's going to cause them to go in the right direction. Could you just comment on that?
Would you like to start, or shall I?
I'll let you go.
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, I'll read you the cities. Adair Village, Antelope, Cave Junction, Gaston, Idana, Monroe, St. Paul, Willamina. Those are the only cities at this point who have not filed. The one we worry about, to be frank, is Willamina. They're 3 years behind. But again, it is some clerks who, you know, preparing a financial statement that can be auditable is not something that everyone is trained to do. In some ways, they probably need to hire an accountant and have that accountant prepare the financial statement and hire an auditor to audit it if they can't prepare that statement themselves. So we don't necessarily want to be punitive. We respect local control, the fact that, you know, they are answerable to their constituents. We want to make sure that they're protecting their constituents. And if there's a public safety risk, that's kind of the issue that concerns me the most, that, you know, Willamina is the largest of those cities. And it, you know, it needs some assistance and some professional help, and we've been in regular contact with them and with their CPA firm to make sure that they can kind of get it together to, you know, to get this organized, because the farther they fall behind, the harder it is for them to catch up. So we try to be sensitive to those issues.
Could I please follow? Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yikes, that list you read wasn't very long. Three of those cities are in my district. So maybe I'll see what I can do to talk to them and see what I can do to help. I'm almost thinking that that the role of the Secretary of State's office would be better to be helpful rather. And I get the spirit of that, too, when you say that's not your first golf club out of your bag is to club them over the head with a 10% fine. But let's see what we can do to be helpful on that. That's all I have to say.
And then we'll do one follow-up, but just so you know, we have a full another panel on this bill, and then we have a whole another bill. So one more follow-up.
To speak to Representative Nierman's point, in the proposed bill, you say you're going to allow a reasonable extension to allow the municipalities to get the audit in. What time frame do you think is reasonable, and could we define that in a more definitive way than leaving it so open-ended and open to interpretation?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, sometimes it's situational. We've had, reasonable cause may be that they discover fraud and they have investigators in looking at their books and they really can't determine for a certain period of time. For Willamina being 3 years behind, if they get the first year done, that would be great, but it's going to take them even longer to get through the next two. So it's very situational. I would be a little because I get the other piece is we haven't had the extraordinary financial problems in these local government cities or counties that have caused huge problems. So we want to go in tentatively and be able to establish a working relationship with them first. So we want to make this something that's sensitive to the situation they're dealing with. So we were trying to figure out if there was a reasonable period of time, and we were a little uncomfortable trying to come up with 90 days or 6 months or 1 year with the fact that it just may not be one size fits all given the circumstances and size of the government.
One more.
Sorry.
All right, last one. Drum roll, please.
This is an interesting topic to me. So right now, Secretary of State's office has the ability to recommend withholding of funds if there's not a correction of deficiencies or two consecutive audit periods. How many times has that been done?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, to my knowledge, probably for, or at least the knowledge of everyone in the office also, 35, 40 years, no one could recall that happening. And I think part of the reason is that the deficiencies, I mean, when they're audited, there's a fine-tooth comb process that goes on, and that there are deficiencies that are identified that are not necessarily affecting their financial condition. It might be that it's a small community with a small group of employees and they can't separate the duties to provide the what we call internal controls, segregation of duties to make sure that there is oversight and checks and controls over activities. So sometimes they just have to live with those deficiencies, and we recognize that. So we have not seen those deficiencies at a level that would make us feel like that they need that 10% withheld. We do get letters from the cities and counties that indicate that they are taking action. They need to provide us with a resolution recognizing the deficiencies identified in the audit report and actions that they're taking to address it. So we get their attention, and that's part of statute that they're required to do that. And we feel like given the seriousness of the deficiencies that are identified and the actions that they're taking that they do follow through, and the next year's accountants are professionally required to follow up on the previous year's deficiencies and findings to see what actions they've taken. So, again, this is we don't follow the state of Washington model, which has 350 auditors who go out and audit every local government in the state of Washington. We essentially have 1.5, maybe 2 FTE that are overseeing the CPAs and monitoring the actions that are taken just to see that the local governments are carrying through their due diligence to make sure that they're managing their finances properly.
All right, thank you very much. So next we'll have Scott Winkles and Rob Beauvais. Is that the French pronunciation, or is that correct?
Madam Chair, it's actually Beauvais or Beauvais.
Beauvais, okay.
My family can't agree.
So. Okay, all right. Go ahead and state your name and proceed.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and we are appearing in support of this bill that may... that may surprise some people given the wording, but we do. League of Oregon Cities does believe an audit or a statement of a financial statement is appropriate. The bill also repeals the requirement that the procedures be approved by the Secretary of State. A municipal audit, besides all of the other requirements you heard, also has to meet the Government Accounting Standards Board's requirements, which are stringent. We have a public contracting code. It's an extra layer and not particularly necessary to have the Secretary of State approve that process. The purpose of the one group that doesn't see the information, and we've talked about the voters and the constituents who if the city doesn't perform an audit, they don't have the knowledge. But another group that doesn't have a picture of the financials of their city is the City Council. And what we've seen when there have been problems, particularly in Oak Ridge, Malala, other places where there have been issues with delinquent audits, that the City Council, when they become knowledgeable, they take action. And they, in Oak Ridge, they had public meetings. They did some very painful financial decisions. And as Dave Barry would say, and I'm not making this up, they did attract the interest of a reality television show called Secret Millionaire, who gave them a grant of $300,000. The point isn't, Malala did the same thing. There were some very difficult decisions in that city when issues came up with their audit. And it is something of a peculiarity in the statute that the Secretary of State's office can withhold shared revenue, liquor revenue, from a city if they don't have not compliant with a plan to correct a deficiency in the audit. But there is no teeth if this municipality fails in the audit. I would say that personally, I've called through the list of cities when it comes out over the last couple of years. We are concerned about Willamina, cities that don't have a certified audit. They can't get their internal theft insurance through City County Insurance Services. So we are taking action to address this issue. And with that, I'm open to your questions.
We'll hear from Mr. Beauvais, and then we'll do the questions for the panel.
Rob Beauvais, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll keep it very brief, 2 points. Ditto to everything he just said. And number two, none of the Oregon's 36 counties are on the wall of shame.
Very nice. All right, questions for this panel. Representative Buehler.
Chair Fagan, my hat's off to the Secretary of State's office in addressing this problem. In my opinion, oversight of local audits has been woefully inadequate in this state for a long time, so I'm glad to see some improvement on this. And one of the things that bothers me in terms of transparency, when reading many of these audits, there's usually a letter to management with other recommendations, which is not very easy, at least in my experience, to locate or get your hands on. Why is that, and could we make that more transparent to the public?
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, I've seen several audits. Usually that's the cover sheet. I know when the League of Oregon City gets an audit, ours comes as the cover sheet of the document, and it's a part of the presentation. I'm not sure if you have a specific example, I can look into it.
I'm not referring to the transmittal letter. There's sometimes a letter to management with regards to other recommendations that is, in my experience, very difficult to locate as a member of the public. Is there a reason why that's the case?
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, I'm familiar with management letters, having reviewed a number of them. At least from the county that I worked in for 21 years, they weren't difficult to locate. But you're right, the letter itself, the management letter, and then the cover letter isn't the audit itself, and the state law requires us to file the audit. I would be concerned if you were to change the law and require the filing of management letters with the Secretary of State, that somehow those management letters might be written differently. Because right now, I think, depending on the audit firm, sometimes they contain some strong language or some suggestions, and if audit firms felt like that was going to be scrutinized by the Secretary of State, I'm not sure if they would think about them or write them differently. I'd have to stew on that.
Other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And before we close the hearing, let the record reflect that Representative Bueller indicated that he reads audits, which I think is a way of him indicating he has a severe sleep problem.
Getting way too personal.
Yes. Great. So without that, is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2174? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2174 and open a – and that's the one that we were potentially going to award. Did we ever get the fiscal? Stand at ease for a moment. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2175 and call Mary back up, and Wendy will read us the bill.
Madam Chair and members, the bill summary for House Bill 2175. House Bill 2175 deletes requirement that state agencies file with the Division of Audits of the Secretary of State documentation of business reasons for exceptions to next day deposits of funds with the state treasurer. The bill also deletes requirement that commodity commissions file annual financial statements with the Division of Audits of the Secretary of State. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Go ahead.
Chair Fagan and members of the committee, my name is Mary Ringer. I'm a deputy director with the Secretary of State's Audits Division. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss House Bill 2175. This bill is mainly a housekeeping bill. It eliminates the requirement that state agencies automatically submit documentation to the Audits Division when they hold money for more than one day before depositing it with the state treasurer. In addition, this bill will eliminate the requirement for commodity commissions to submit their annual financial statements to the Audits Division. State law requires state agencies to deposit monies with the state treasurer not later than one business day after receipt. This is also known as the next day deposit rule. Agencies are authorized to take longer than the next day if they save documentation of a valid business reason in their official files and they submit a copy of that documentation to the Audits Division. The State Treasurer also requires submission of this documentation. The types of submissions to the Audits Division generally do not relate to any of our ongoing audit activities. However, because the documentation could become relevant to our annual audits, this bill will require state agencies to submit the documentation to us upon request. The second issue that this bill addresses is that certain submissions by commodity commissions. Statutes require commodity commissions to submit their annual financial statements to the Department of Agriculture and to the Audits Division within 90 days of the fiscal year end or by September 30th. This bill would eliminate the requirement for the commodity commissions to submit their audit reports to the Audits Division. These reports generally do not relate to any of our current audit activities. Moreover, this bill would require the commodity commissions to submit them to us upon request. Finally, we wanted to cover two minor amendments that we asked for in response to requests from the Department of Agriculture and the State Treasurer's Office. The first amendment would shorten the time frame for commodity commission submission of financial statements to the Department of Agriculture from 90 days down to 30 days. The Department of Agriculture requested this change basically to align the statute to current practice. The second amendment adds text that makes it even clearer that House Bill 2175 applies to agencies that bank with the Treasury. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill. Happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Did you want to add anything? Okay. All right. Well, that was easy. And I know that Mary already mentioned the audit, but Lauren, would you also like to comment on the amendment?
For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I just wanted to address the parts that relate to the commission itself. We have the oversight duties over the state's 23 commodity commissions, and part of that is their financial reporting. Very supportive and appreciative of the Secretary of State's office working on this bill. It's just one less step for our commodity commissions to have to make in their financial reporting. The second is the amendment itself and the reduction from 90 days to 30 days. That just mirrors what we're already doing today with the commodity commissions. They have worked with us to get their financial reports in quickly so that they can be submitted with our agency's financial reports in the state's CAFR reporting schedule, and that's the state's consolidated financial reporting. So appreciate your consideration there.
Any questions for anyone on this panel?
Sorry.
There's a shocker. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So wouldn't you have the same problem with this situation if the Secretary of State is requesting these documents and they're not forthcoming without having a leverage like you asked for with regards to the previous bill? Why not basically cut to the question? Why aren't you asking for the same 10% leverage you have with regards to the local audits?
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, is that directed for us for auditing?
Yeah.
We're basically just a repository of these Commodity Commission reports, and most of them are not audited. Mm-hmm. That's why they can submit them shortly after year end.
Mm-hmm. But what leverage do you have if they don't submit it to you?
We're just a repository. We don't have any leverage.
Okay.
The Department of Agriculture works with the Commodity Commissions, and he'd be better able to speak, but they actually have someone who monitors and is in contact with Commodity Commissions.
So, Chair, I think I can answer that. This is the initial part of the leverage is the Commodity Commissioners are appointed by the director. And we have appointment authority over that. The second part of that is if they do not submit their financial reports on time, we can withhold the approval of their budgets and ongoing expenditures, and the director can do that through an emergency order, which would prevent them basically from operating until that happened. I don't ever recall in my tenure even coming close to having to do anything like that. We have an oversight program manager who works very closely with the commodity commissions, and I think really they do a great job of doing their reporting.
The reason I push this issue because there is precedence of major agencies in the state not doing their annual internal audits as required in statutory law, with no real leverage to make that happen. And I realize it's not the Secretary of State's responsibility to make sure those annual audits are done, but there is no one really overseeing and making sure that kind of scrutiny is taking place. So I encourage you to think a little bit more deeply about this issue.
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, I'm not entirely clear. We conduct annual financial audit of all the state agencies. They submit their financial statements through the state SARS, the State Accounting Reporting Group, and that's compiled into it. So was there a specific...
Mr. Blackmer, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you re-identify yourself record?
Gary Blackmer, Director, Secretary of State Audits Division. I'm not entirely clear what an example might be of what you raise as a concern.
I'll get you the example.
Oh, great.
Yep.
Great. Well, if there are any other questions, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And we'll also carry this over to Thursday and have a work session on Thursday. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2175? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2175. And I definitely know who we're assigning to work groups when anything has to do with audits. So you guys are all off the hook. You can sigh a big sigh of relief. So if there's anything else for the good of the order, I will close the House Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee. Government Effectiveness Committee. Protection and Government.